This is the Back Porch Education Podcast. Today on the porch, Steve and I are joined by two super old dudes, Malibus and Titterus. Good evening, good morning, good afternoon, everybody. Today, the episode is the poem. That's what we're going to be working on and working through. We've got a doozy for you. It's a long one. It is Build Soil by Robert Frost.
Yeah, I don't know if doozy is the correct adjective or not. Whopper might be the...
Yeah, right. It's a big one. It is. It's going to take a long time to work through, but it's worth it. I think we're, oh man, I'm going to resist the opportunity to use the title there. But we're going to get stuff done. It's lengthy. Hang in there, and enjoy it. I think maybe I will say just a word or two about the poem before we get started. Build Soil is written by Robert Frost, and it was written, as best I know, in 1932. It was published in 36, and sort of, okay, so it's written in blank verse, which is basically just like unrhymed pentameter. And it the subtitle of the poem is A Political Pastoral. So just a brief word about that. Pastorals are a very old form of poetry. They've been used since before Christ, and they were often written. I think Thucydides wrote some of the first ones, and Virgil certainly picked up that genre. And Frost is pretty explicitly in line with them. Like, he even uses those two names. So Titterus and Malibus are the two pastors, that is shepherds, having a conversation on a field, right? And they're talking about politics, which is right in line with this, how this genre has functioned historically. So, I think that's enough. I could nerd out on some of the ancient stuff, but I think I'll just leave it there for now. And we can hop into the poem and then maybe
I guess we
see
should
what
explain,
happens after that.
We should probably explain that you are Titterus and I am Malibus.
That's right. Yeah. So I will be reading Titterus's part. Steve, much to his chagrin and only with much coaxing, has been cast as Malibus. And so he's been a good sport for this. So that's how that's going to work.
The jury is still seated on that fact, sir.
Right. Yeah. Up to this point, he's been a good sport. He might just start reading Bono lyrics in the middle of this to make me mad. All right, Steve. Well, Malibus speaks first in this dialogue. So you're up, but I'll read the title and we can hop right in. Build Soil, A Political Pastoral.
Why, Titterus, but you've forgotten me. I'm Malibus, the potato man. The one you had the talk with, you remember, here on this very campus years ago. Hard times have struck me, and I'm on the move. I've had to give my interval farm up for interest, and I've bought a mountain farm for nothing down, all out of doors of a place. All woods and pasture only fit for sheep. But sheep is what I'm going into next. I'm done forever with potato crops at 30 cents a bushel. Give me sheep. I know wool's down to 7 cents a pound, but I don't calculate to sell my wool. I didn't my potatoes. I consume them. I'll dress up in sheep's clothing and eat sheep. The muse takes care of you. You live by writing your poems on a farm and call that farming. Oh, I don't blame you. I say take life easy. I should myself, only I don't know how. But have some pity on us who have to work. Why don't you use your talents as a writer to advertise our farms to city buyers? Or else write something to improve food prices. Get in a poem toward the next election.
O Melibus, I have half a mind to take a writing hand in politics. Before now, poetry has taken notice of wars, and what are wars but politics transformed from chronic to acute and bloody?
I may be wrong, but, Titorus, to me, the times seem revolutionary bad.
The question is whether they've reached a depth of desperation that would warrant poetry's leaving love's alternations, joy and grief, the weather's alternations, summer and winter, our age-long theme for the uncertainty of judging who is a contemporary liar, who in particular, when all alike get called as much in clashes of ambition. Life may be tragically bad, and I make bold to sing it so, but do I dare name names and tell you who by name is wicked? Whittier's luck with Skipper Ireson awes me. Many men's luck with greatest Washington, who sat for Stuart's portrait, but who sat equally for the nation's constitution. I prefer to sing safely in the realm of types, composite, and imagined people, to affirm there is such a thing as evil, personified, but ask to be excused from saying on a jury, here's the guilty.
I doubt if you're convinced the times are bad.
I keep my eye on Congress, Melibus. They're in the best position of us all to know if anything is very wrong. I mean, they could be trusted to give the alarm if Earth were thought about to change its axis or a star coming to dilate the sun. As long as lightly all their livelong sessions, like a yard full of schoolboys out at recess, before their plays and games were organized, they yelling mix tag, hide and seek, hopscotch, and leapfrog in each other's way, all's well. Let newspapers profess to fear the worst. Nothing's portentous. I am reassured.
Is socialism needed, do you think?
We have it now, for socialism is an element in any government. There's no such thing as socialism pure, except as an abstraction of the mind. There's only democratic socialism, monarchic socialism, oligarchic, the last being what they seem to have in Russia. You often get it most in monarchy, least in democracy. In practice, pure, I don't know what it would be. No one knows. I have no doubt, like all the loves when philosophized together into one sickness of the body and the soul. Thank God our practice holds the loves apart, beyond embarrassing self-consciousness, where natural friends are met, where dogs are kept, where women pray with priests. There is no love. There's only love of men and women, love of children, love of friends, of men, of God, divine love, human love, parental love, roughly discriminated for the rough.
Poetry itself once more is back in love.
Pardon the analogy, my Melibus, for sweeping me away. Let's see, where was I?
But don't you think more should be socialized than is?
What should you mean by socialized?
Make good for everyone. Things like inventions, made so we all should get the good of them. All not just great exploiting businesses.
We sometimes only get the bad of them. In your sense of the word, ambition has been socialized. The first propensity to be attempted, greed may well come next. But the worst one of all to leave uncurbed, unsocialized, is ingenuity, which for no sordid self-aggrandizement, for nothing but its own blind satisfaction, in this it is as much like hate as love, works in the dark as much against as for us. Even while we talk, some chemist at Columbia is stealthily contriving wool from jute that, when let loose upon the grazing world, will put 10,000 farmers out of sheep. Everyone asks for freedom for himself. The man, free love, the businessman, free trade, the writer and talker, free speech and free press. Political ambition has been taught. By being punished back, it is not free. It must at some point gracefully refrain. Greed has been taught a little abnegation, and shall be more before we're done with it. It is just fool enough to think itself self-taught, but our brute snarling and lashing taught it. None shall be as ambitious as he can. None should be as ingenious as he could. Not if I had my say. Bounds should be set to ingenuity for being so cruel in bringing change unheralded on the unready.
I elect you to put the curb on it.
Were I dictator, I'll tell you what I'd do.
What should you do?
I'd let things take their course, and then I'd claim the credit for the outcome.
You'd make a sort of safety-first dictator.
Don't let the things I say against myself betray you into taking sides against me, or it might get you into trouble with me. I'm not afraid to prophesy the future and be judged by the outcome, Melibus. Listen, and I will take my dearest risk. We're always too much out or too much in. At present, from a cosmical dilation, we're so much out that the odds are against our ever getting inside in again. But inside in is where we've got to get. My friends all know I'm interpersonal, but long before I'm interpersonal, away, way down inside, I'm personal. Just so before we're international, we're national and act as nationals. The colors are kept unmixed on the palate, or better, on dish plates all around the room, so the effect when they are mixed on canvas may seem almost exclusively designed. Some minds are so confounded, intermental, they remind me of pictures on a palette. Look at what happened. Surely some god pinks it. Come look at my significant mud pie. It's hard to tell which is the worst abhorrence, whether it's persons pied or nations pied. Don't let me seem to say the exchange, the encounter, may not be the important thing at the last. It may well be. We meet. I don't say when, but must bring to the meeting the maturest, the longest saved up, raciest localist we have strength of reserve in us to bring.
Diderus, sometimes I'm perplexed myself to find the good of commerce. Why should I have to sell you my apples and buy yours? It can't be just to give the robber a chance to catch them and take toll of them in transit. Too mean a thought to get much comfort out of. I figure that like any bandying of words or toys, it ministers to health. It very likely quickens and refines us.
To market, 'tis our destiny to go. But much as in the end we bring for sale there, there is still more we never bring or should bring. More that should be kept back. The soil, for instance. In my opinion, though we both know poets who fall all over each other to bring soil and even subsoil and hard pan to market. To sell the hay off, let alone the soil, is an unpardonable sin in farming. The moral is, make a late start to market. Let me preach to you, will you, Melibus?
Preach on. I thought you were already preaching. But preach and see if I can tell the difference.
Needless to say to you, my argument is not to lure the city to the country. Let those possess the land, and only those, who love it with a love so strong and stupid that they may be abused and taken advantage of and made fun of by business, law, and art, they still hang on. That so much of the earth's unoccupied need not make us uneasy. We don't pretend to complete occupancy. The world's one globe, human society, another softer globe that slightly flattened, rests on the world and clinging slowly rolls. We have our own round shape to keep unbroken. The world size has no more to do with us than has the universe's. We are balls. We are round from the same source of roundness. We are both round because the mind is round, because all reasoning is in a circle. At least that's why the universe is round.
If what you're preaching is a line of conduct, just what am I supposed to do about it? Reason in circles?
No, refuse to be seduced back to the land by any claim the land may seem to have on man to use it. Let none assume to till the land but farmers. I only speak to you as one of them. You shall go to your run-out mountain farm, poor castaway of commerce, and so live that none shall ever see you come to market. Not for a long, long time. Plant, breed, produce, but what you raise or grow, why, feed it out, eat it or plow it under where it stands to build the soil. For what is more accursed than an impoverished soil, pale and metallic? What cries more to our kind for sympathy? I'll make a compact with you, Melibus, to match you deed for deed and plan for plan. Friends crowd around me with their five-year plans that Soviet Russia has made fashionable. You come to me and I'll unfold to you a five-year plan I call so not because it takes 10 years or so to carry out, rather because it took 5 years at least to think it out. Come close, let us conspire in self-restraint, if in restraint of trade. You will go to your run-out mountain farm and do what I command you. I take care to command only what you meant to do anyway. That is my style of dictator. Build soil, turn the farm in upon itself until it can contain itself no more, but sweating full drips wine and oil a little. I will go to my run-out social mind and be as unsocial with it as I can. The thought I have and my first impulse is to take to market, I will turn it under. The thought from that thought, I will turn it under. And so on, to the limit of my nature. We are too much out, and if we won't draw in, we shall be driven in. I was brought up a state rights free trade democrat. What's that? An inconsistency. The state shall be laws to itself, it seems, and yet have no control of what it sells or what it buys. Suppose someone comes near me, who in rate of speech and thinking is so much my better, I am imposed upon, silenced and discouraged. Do I submit to being supplied by him as the more economical producer, more wonderful, more beautiful producer? No, I unostentatiously move off far enough for my thought flow to resume. Thought product and food product are to me nothing compared to the producing of them. I sent you once a song with the refrain, let me be the one to do what is done. My share at least, lest I be empty idle. Keep off each other and keep each other off. You see, the beauty of my proposal is it needn't wait on general revolution. I bid you to a one-man revolution, the only revolution that is coming. We're too unseparate out among each other, with goods to sell and notions to impart. A youngster comes to me with half a quatrain to ask me if I think it worth the pains of working out the rest, the other half. I am brought guaranteed young prattle poems, made publicly in school above suspicion of plagiarism and help of cheating parents. We congregate embracing from distrust as much as love and too close in to strike and be so very striking. Steal away, the song says. Steal away and stay away. Don't join too many gangs. Join few, if any. Join the United States and join the family. But not much in between, unless a college. Is it a bargain, Shepherd Melibus?
Probably, but you're far too fast and strong for my mind to keep working in your presence. I can tell better after I get home. Better a month from now when cutting posts or mending fence, it all comes back to me, what I was thinking when you interrupted my life train logic. I agree with you, we're too unseparate. And going home from company means coming to our senses.
All right, Steve. And now the inevitable question. What'd you think?
A little bit of water and you got mud.
Yeah.
I mean, you do this to me every time, but whether it's a short poem or in this case, a 15-minute poem, what do you think? I'll be honest that I think a great deal when I'm working through a poem, especially if it's something new to me, and I had read through this a few times. But generally speaking, as I view poetry, I have those poems that I've known for years and years and years, and in many cases taught them to students and thought about them and bandied them about with other minds. And then there are ones that are still, I'm still getting used to, you know. Mm-hmm. And this is certainly one that's still new to me. The few times I've gone through it, something different has come out every time. It does seem timeless. I know it's hitched up to what's going on in 1932 when he wrote it. But here in 2019, we still have discussions about socialism and how best to govern ourselves and the good of others. And
right. Economy.
Economy and community. And it even, you know, got into nationalism, which has become a big word in our day. So there's a lot there. And when I come to a poem, I think even more than what discrete philosophical thought it gives me, I look first for how it moves me, and then I try to think about why.
Yeah. Okay, that's cool. I like that. And I think that's a pretty helpful way for kind of navigating it, right? Because, you know, you have a 14-line sonnet or you have a little 40-line whatever. It hits fast enough that you can kind of swallow it all at once. You don't have to chew much. But this thing is pushing 300 lines. And so the...
Well,
the option to just say, "Oh, it's about this." Yeah, that's harder, right? You can't digest it all at the same time.
Well, it's got a bunch of levels. It's got a bunch of levels to it. It is long, but it's also two people talking.
Mm-hmm.
And I it shocks me at moments when it's using old Greek names that kind of make me feel pastoral, you know, that these are two shepherds. This is a long time ago. And then he'll reference Columbia University or he'll reference something from his time. Whoa, this is 20th century, not 5th century BC Greece.
Right.
And so it's, there's a bunch going on at once. And, you know, there's a whole lot there that makes me want to say, why in a podcast on education, A, do we start every one of them off with a poem? And B, this was a long one. In fact, this is a whole tantamount to the whole episode of a podcast. What are we doing?
Mm-hmm. Well, we're building soil, Steve.
You're a jerk.
That may be so.
But what does that have to do with the poem?
I am not in a situation where I can disagree with you there. Yeah, you're right. I do think that we need to answer that question, right? It's pretty serious.
So to set things up, you do this to your students on a regular basis.
I do, yes. This poem, I wouldn't have a day where I would read this to all of my classes. But if you sat in Mr. Dilworth's Latin class or Mr. Dilworth's theology class or ethics class, whatever it was, there were a couple of times a year, you know, two, maybe three times a year, where each class would hear this poem, right? So no matter what you were doing, you heard, if you were in my classroom, you heard this two or three times a year. And it's kind of long, right? Like it's a lot to read at the beginning. But let me kind of tell you about the way that students responded to it. So first off, I really wouldn't read it like the first week of school. They were already used to me reading poetry. And probably by that point, I had read them something a little longer, at least like 70 or 80 lines, to kind of give them a chance to just practice the skill of sitting and listening quietly to something, like focusing on something for a little while, because that's hard to do, especially when you don't have the text in front of you. And so then I would say, okay, everybody, it's Build Soil Day. The first time, and they would say, I don't know what that is. Yeah, you're getting ready to find out, kid. And so, yeah, you know, I would say, okay, guys, girls, this is a long one. It's going to be a long poem. It's going to take me 20 minutes to read this. And it's a conversation. It's going to get confusing. There's going to be some stuff you don't know. So I would try to guide them through it a little bit. I would try to explain, like I did at the beginning of this episode, sort of, it's two men talking. They're talking about politics. And so here's how you should listen. Listen to kind of what they're talking about. Try to figure out what it is they're discussing. If you have a word that you don't understand, write that word down, right? That's something that we can talk about afterwards. And so then I would say, if you get distracted, which you probably will, that's okay. Just once you've realized that you have tuned out, tune back in and try to get with me again. And let's just see what happens. And so we would read it. Or I would read it, that is. And that's basically what would happen. You know, the students would tune out and sort of tune back in as they were able. And sometimes it was pretty frustrating for them. And there was a lot of resistance to it. But what I've noticed is that through reading it multiple times a year, when I would read this in the fourth quarter, I would have students, even my seventh graders, I almost think I'm embellishing here, because I think back on it like, did that really happen? But yeah, it really did happen that even my seventh graders would say, all right, you know, like they were excited to hear this poem again after they had kind of worked through it a couple times. So this really was like a touchstone of my course, whatever course it was. I would be quoting this a lot in my classroom. And I think it deserves that.
Well, and that's what I love about shared experience, is that it becomes this touchstone.
Yeah.
Right. I've taught a class a few times, real life, R-E-E-L life, which has been a study in film. It takes multiple forms. One is watching films and discussing them, which we typically did one day a week. They would watch it outside of class and come, and we'd talk about it for 45 minutes in class. But the other 4 days of the week were coming up with, each of them would come up with a pitch, and then they would have a big couple of days of argumentation about which pitch they were going to take. And then they would construct storyboard and script, et cetera, for a film, short film, make it. And typically, depending on how motivated they were, that would get done middle to late April, maybe early May, leaving us with time at the end of that experience to just sit in class and watch films. Now that we've made one, in particular, I'd be pushing them towards the art of filmmaking, lighting and angle and choices and that sort of thing. But one of the things I did to my last time, and it isn't this that made it my last time I taught this, I don't think, but they all, I still have them as students. They'll be seniors. The sophomores that I had will be seniors this coming year. And last year, at least as juniors, they kept bringing up this film that they absolutely hated.
Right.
It was a 1927 film, Metropolis, silent film. You had to, that's one of the things that made it really long. It was 3 hours long.
Wow.
And one of the, it challenged them because they had to read, you know, the dialogue. And everything takes forever. And of course, they're so used to the polished CGI, George Lucas, Steven Spielberg, bada boom.
Right.
You know, that they don't have much respect for how much work it used to be to make a film back before the computer did it all for you. And yet there's an experience of the, I think they believe that if they whined loud enough, they certainly tried to prove this true, that if they whined loud enough, you know, a 45 minute class was a 3 hour endeavor. This is about a week of classes that we spent watching this.
Right.
And they were just physically in agony.
Right.
Oh, Mr. Ellie's the worst film. Why? What makes it bad? And I just keep pushing them to try and see why they were doing what they were doing. Is there anything redeeming about it? Why is it still around? Why, you know, we were watching this, streaming it off Netflix, which at the time was carrying it.
Hmm.
Well, Netflix is all about viewability, and it's not on Netflix anymore. but why is it on there? You know, this Netflix is your place, your go-to place for entertainment. Why, what's going on? Why would people still watch this, et cetera? So I think that there is something about the elongated experience, whether it's a three-hour movie or a 20-minute poem. I teach a lot of long poems. They're not even necessarily looked at as, you know, Homer.
Sure.
And Virgil.
Sure.
And Dante and Milton. And some of what makes some of those very difficult is their poetic form. If they had written it as a story, kids wouldn't struggle with it near as much.
Yeah, it's so weird. It's weird. Right. And I think that's, yeah, we need to get into that. I think that that's something that deserves its own episode. Sort of looking at art in the classroom and what exactly we're doing there. And maybe to sort of put a pin on that question and also tie it back to this poem. I would like to quote the three lines of this poem that stuck out to me the first time I read it, right? So when I read this poem, Build Soil, the first time, there was a ton that I just was like, I don't even know what's going on here. But there were these three lines that really stuck out, were really important to me, and have informed my reading and have encouraged me to come back to it over and over again so that I can continue to learn more about it. So here they are. It's towards the end of the poem where Tityrus is telling Melibus what to do. And what he says is, build soil, turn the farm in upon itself until it can contain itself no more, but sweating full, drips wine and oil a little. I think that's pretty good. I think that's pretty ripe. That's a powerful image for a lot of vocation, maybe just vocation generally, like what we're really trying to do as we live and attempt to live well, right? To work the thing over in a way that is generative until it can't help but produce.
Yep. Those are great lines. So listener, let me lean into the microphone and let you know that there is a banner day coming at our next episode when we finally figure out why Jason reads these poems to us every week. Yep. And It might even have something to do with what we think you ought to be doing in your classroom or homeschool setting. So tune in for the next episode when we talk about art in the classroom.
Steve, I would only add that next time you're going to ask me why I read this. We may not find out, but we'll discuss it anyway.
The lawyers demand that we put that kind of disclaimer in there, I guess. Backwards education.